طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. Because our government and media are so controlled by Israeli propaganda, their multi-million dollar lobby machine, the influence of direct funding of political campaigns, we rarely hear about the actual deleterious effects of colonialism, apartheid, military occupation, land theft, and house demolitions from the mouths of Palestinians who are living this nightmare. The purpose of This Week in Palestine, as you know, is to give voice to these Palestinians. And now, to add to our voice, the Cambridge Bethlehem People to People Project will be presenting a new Zoom virtual forum series called Voices from Palestine. It will feature voices from the ground in the West Bank and Gaza. On April 30th, 2023, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, the hour-long program will launch, featuring Palestinian activists, cultural workers, community organizers, educators, and health workers speaking on the ground from Palestine. Timely interviews with audience participation. The first program features Kitam Edelby, who was an expressive therapist and activist. She works on the ground in the West Bank with formerly incarcerated young men, Bedouin women, children, and teachers. Kitam fosters healing in towns, villages, and refugee camps in Palestine. As a Palestinian, her work is not just about creative therapy. It is resistance and resilience in the face of stress and trauma created by occupation. To learn more about the project and to register for the first program, just type into your computer's search engine, Cambridge Bethlehem People to People Project. It will bring you to their webpage. At the top of the homepage, you will see Voices from Palestine. Click on it to learn more about the program and to register for the first broadcast on April 30th at 1 p.m. The organizing campaign for Palestinian rights in the United States is most aggressively being waged on college campuses. And at the center of that organizing is a rapidly growing organization, Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP. They have been met by aggressive tactics of retaliation from campus Jewish organizations and university administrators, being pressed by wealthy alumni donors to silence SJP. Students for Justice in Palestine recently met at their annual conference to assess its past work and strategize for the future, and our feature presentation this week is a discussion of that conference sponsored by Mondo Weiss News Service in the following podcast, which also takes a hard look at Israel's involvement in the development of the militarization of our police through a super training facility being built in Atlanta, Georgia.
This is the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm Dave Reed. In February, Students for Justice in Palestine held their 12th annual conference in Los Angeles for a weekend of critical discussion, movement building, and political education. Michael Aria spoke with a member of the group's steering committee about the themes of the conference, the state of Palestine activism on U.S. campuses, and the victories of 2022. After that, we'll hear about the Stop Cop City protests in Atlanta and the links between the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange and Israeli police. Adam Horowitz spoke to Kamau Franklin, an activist and organizer in Atlanta involved in the Stop Cop City movement.
So let's start with the annual conference that just happened last month. What were your impressions of how it went? And also, what were the big themes this year?
Just before I jump into that, I wanted to give a little background on NSJP. So we are a collective of organizers. We support over 200 Palestine solidarity organizations across the U.S. and Canada. We promote an agenda grounded in freedom, solidarity, equality, safety, historical justice, and we seek to elevate the student Palestine solidarity organizations network to get to a deeper level of political engagement. So I guess with that framing, I'll jump right into conference. Our 11th annual conference was titled Cultivating the Future, a United Student Movement. And it really, the main goal was focused on political education and unity and uniting organizations across Turtle Island. It focused on the political moment that we're organizing in and the context of what's happening in Palestine and how we, as the student movement for Palestinian liberation in the diaspora, can utilize our collective power to pressure institutions and work within our communities to advance the struggle for Palestinian liberation. This conference came at a really precarious moment for the Palestinian people, which I'll touch on more later. But the ever-present violence inflicted on our people by the Zionist Project has been compounded by its extreme right-wing government, who've explicitly stated that their mission is eradication of Palestinians from every inch of Palestine. But at the same time, we are witnessing Palestinian youth and, you know, those in solidarity with our struggle reject the occupation, and we're seeing revitalization of our movement, a new vision, a new direction, and stronger organization. And so as we witness the movement broadly, and more specifically the student movement, engage in such powerful and impactful organizing, we as steering members were confronted with one question when preparing for this conference. And that question was, as we build power in our local groups, how can we unite to elevate our local organizing into a transnational, proactive, and unified strategy for fighting for liberation on campus? And I'd like to say that our role as steering committee members isn't to be leaders of the student movement in the U.S. and Canada, but to be more facilitators. So we provide the groundwork and the spaces and the resources for students across Palestine solidarity orgs to come together, collaborate, and build power together. So I just wanted to emphasize that we're facilitators and we don't consider ourselves leaders of the movement in the diaspora. And so with that, those questions underpinned every single aspect of our conference. So our workshops, our nationwide discussions, regional convenings, our plenary and our keynote advanced the question of unity, radical imagination, and building a unified student movement. And so throughout the whole weekend, we engaged in radical visioning, laying the foundation for a unified movement that we can cultivate, refine, and actualize together.
We've seen some big moments in recent years on this issue just within the United States, an increase in the number of Congress members who push legislation on the issue. We've seen big reports on Israeli apartheid from mainstream human rights groups in recent years, the Ben & Jerry's decision to stop selling its ice cream in the illegally occupied West Bank. Have these developments coincided with an expansion of your organization? And is the number of students and chapters, has it been rising?
So I think while there has been an expansion in the number of SJPs and the number of students being members and organizing in SJPs, as well as, you know, other Palestinian youth organizations, I think it's more important to speak on the expansion in the scope of work that the student movement is doing right now, and the role of students in pioneering new tactics and strategies and also targets in the fight for Palestinian liberation in the context of a college campus. Today, as you know, we've done historically, that we build on a very long legacy of student organizing for Palestine. We continue to push the political envelope, and we really are trying to expand the parameters of, you know, quote unquote, what's possible for a movement. So this can look like academic boycott campaigns, which call for cutting institutional relationships with the Zionist entity, or divestment, which mobilize broad coalitions for Palestine liberation under the frameworks of anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism, and collective liberation. This also looks like demilitarization campaigns, which could target curriculums or like recruiting in terms of like the defense, you know, defense recruiting in STEM programs on college campuses. You know, you brought up the example of Ben and Jerry's, and I think that students are deeply connected with examples of BDS like Ben and Jerry's, which are very popular. But it's also important to note that the motivation for the growth of student organizing comes from a collectively shared truth. And that truth is that the Palestinian people are not free, and we as students have the power to change that. This is the fundamental burden, and you know, the genuine belief that we as students have the political power to fight for Palestinian liberation. That is what inspires the creation of SJP chapters and increases membership. And that's what motivates creative and politically sophisticated campaigns on college campuses. So whether it was the General Union of Palestinian Students, which we refer to as GUPS, students have always had a role in the broader movement for liberation. And so that's something really exciting to see chapters growing and stepping into that power.
2022 was marked by more legal action and complaints from pro-Israel lawfare groups, a tactic that we've seen more and more in recent years. We've also seen the IHRA controversial working definition of anti-Semitism pushed in schools and universities across the country. Can you speak to the current climate when it comes to Palestine activism on campuses and what kind of challenges students have faced recently?
So I think when it comes to IHRA and, you know, the new IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, it's important that we ground ourselves in thinking about how Zionist tactics of repression are rooted in very deep-seated anti-Palestinian racism and are fundamentally illegitimate. You know, you mentioned how IHRA is affecting student organizing, and although there have been increased attempts at repression and censorship of Palestinian organizers, it also points towards the power and the impact that the student movement is having as the Zionist lobby feels threatened and continues to push IHRA. And so we're using this repression and we're spinning it as a way to mobilize our base. It's really a new frontier of organizing. I mean, earlier I spoke about how the scope of student organizing is expanding. So it is a new frontier of student organizing, and it speaks to the creativity and the motivation of student organizers. You know, I think IHRA is a very predictable move. Student organizers are not going to be silenced and will not negotiate their language in fear of these predictable anti-Palestinian smear campaigns. So now that it's just being put into legislation, we just have to be a little bit more creative in our organizing and, you know, not let Zionists silence their voices or quell our organizing work.
We've seen so much violence in the region recently. And, you know, just, you know, these last couple of weeks, this terrible examples of, you know, settler violence, the worst we've seen in years. Before that, you know, increased repression, raids. There's obviously a new far right government. Israel just announced it's going to expand settlements yet again. And last year was the deadliest year for the West Bank in quite some time. I was wondering if you could speak to how what happens in Palestine informs or maybe even recalibrates your activism and solidarity as a U.S.-based organization?
So as I mentioned earlier, as students and student organizers in the diaspora, we know that students outside of Palestine have always had a very important role in the movement for liberation, beginning with GUPS, so that's General Union for Palestinian Students, and now SJPs. So before the disenfranchisement of GUPS, it had a really important role in producing analysis and connecting students across Turtle Island. And now SJPs are building on that legacy, filling in that role and even expanding it. But to answer your question more specifically, the student movement and the movement as a whole outside of occupied Palestine is consistently seeking to respond to what's happening on the ground, as it mobilized in May 2021 for Sheikh Jarrah to stop the forced evictions. Actually, you know, eviction isn't the best word in that context, but the dispossession, that was occurring and that's still occurring in that neighborhood. And now as we're mobilizing for Nablus, which, you know, no doubt Nablus and what's happening right now will feature very heavily in different Israeli apartheid weeks across the US and Canada that are coming this coming month. On top of that, though, I think it's really important to remember the role that we play as students, since we do live and work out of the Imperial Corps. And that is the Imperial Corps that contributes materially and financially to maintaining violence and settler colonial occupation in Palestine. Generally, raising awareness is one role, but students in the Imperial Corps have had the opportunity to directly attack and dismantle the structures of violence that are in place here in the US and Canada, because those structures of violence are really what the Zionist regime is dependent and contingent on. So for national SJP, the steering committee, that role looks like connecting student groups across the country to create and build lots of transnational work that leads to a greater transnational movement. It can also look like supporting SJP chapters as they build divestment campaigns and take on actions ranging from material support to the Zionist regime to fossil fuels and, you know, tackling non-ethical investments that private and public universities are making with their endowments. So tying in conference, we hope that our 2023 conference has left students prepared to confront Zionism on their college campuses more than ever before through principled and strategic organizing. The goal was really to provide those tools and training to connect and unify our movement.
And finally, I'm wondering what you would identify as some maybe 2022 campus victories for the movement.
First of all, the revitalization and strengthening of student campaigns that we're seeing right now can be attributed to the tenacity and creativity of student organizers and the increased mobilizations that happened after 2021. Something very interesting that we're seeing and that's very inspiring and powerful is the proliferation of divestment campaigns across college campuses. Divestment is passing almost unanimously. So now we're seeing a shift from divestment campaigns looking like SJPs versus student councils to more SJPs tackling administration. So one example of this is University of British Columbia, which is in Canada. And like I said earlier, steering committee does support universities in Canada. So they passed divestment on March 23rd, 2022. With the majority of their student senators supporting their campaign. And it immediately went into institutional implementation, but now they're facing institutional stalling from the administration. So they've won the campus, and now their new target is the administration. So outside of divestment campaigns, we have like boycott campaigns, we have anti-IRA campaigns. A great example of a strong campus victory comes out of Georgetown University in DC, where a coalition of graduate and undergraduate students blocked $30,000 of student funding from financing a trip to Israel with the pro-Israel org. It's called iTrek or Israel Trek. And they managed to fully cut the trip's institutional links to Georgetown. And, you know, though that's in line with the BDS principles of academic boycott. So I think what we're seeing right now is very powerful. And, you know, our overall takeaways is that there's a resurgence of student power on campuses. We're organizing more deeply and student organizers are more politically disciplined. And we're also seeing a lot of creativity in strategy and in scope as we, you know, continue to tackle Zionism on our college campuses.
Oh, thanks so much for chatting with us today.
On January 18th, police in Atlanta, Georgia, raided a peaceful encampment of protesters in the Wilani Forest southeast of the city, killing activist Manuel Turan, who went by the name Tortuguita. Their death brought the issue of Cop City and the movement that had grown over the previous 2 years to stop it into the international spotlight. Cop City is the name activists have given to the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center, a $90 million police training compound proposed by the Atlanta Police Foundation and its corporate patrons such as Cox Media, Delta Airlines, the Koch brothers, and Home Depot, among others. At over 300 acres, the center would be the largest police training facility in the United States and is slated to include a mock city where police will train with firearms, tear gas, helicopters, and explosive devices. The movement to stop Cop City has grown since the project was first announced in 2021 and has actively made the connection between the project and a multitude of issues from police violence, climate change, to Palestine and the practice of training U.S. law enforcement with Israeli police. Kamau Franklin is the founder of Community Movement Builders, a member-based collective of black people creating sustainable, self-determining communities through cooperative economic advancement and collective community organizing, and has been one of the lead spokespeople for the Stop Cop City movement. In addition, he is a founder of Black Power Media, a black radical independent media project seeking to challenge the narrative about black politics and the black condition. He spoke with our executive editor, Adam Horowitz, about the protest movement.
Kamau Franklin, welcome to the Mondo Weiss podcast.
I appreciate being here. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're excited for you to be here. So today we are going to be talking about the movement to defeat Cop City. I am sure we have listeners all over the United States, all over the world. I'm sure some are very familiar with what Cop City is, and others are hearing about it for the first time. So could we just start off by explaining what is Cop City?
Well, Cop City is a militarized police training center that the city of Atlanta, along with the Atlanta Police Foundation, dozens of corporations have put money into supporting this training facility. It was developed after the 2020 uprisings, or I should say more accurately, they decided to move forward with it after the 2020 uprisings, as a way, as we see it, to stop movement activity, to train to better react to movement activity, and also as a way to continue the over-policing of the black community. Now, the reason we think this training center is so dangerous and is not just some run-of-the-mill place where the cops are training is the level of the build-out of this training center and the militarized capacity of the center. So the center will be the largest training center in the country. It will have over 12 firing ranges. It will have mock cities for them to practice crowd control and to practice urban warfare training. They already build their current center as being a paramilitary center, and this center is built as being a military grade training center. In its first iteration of plans, it included a landing pad for a Black Hawk helicopter. It also had included a place for detonating explosives. They've now said that they've taken those things out, but we don't necessarily know how true that is. In addition, that this training center mentioned that it's going to be the largest in the country. Atlanta is currently no more than the 20th largest police force in the country. But yet they're going to have the largest training center in the country, and 43% of the officers to be trained at the center will be officers from outside of Georgia. And in addition to that, Georgia currently does training with the Israeli Police Department, and we know that training is going to be brought to Cop City. And so, as we like to say, the same tactics and strategies that are used against Palestinians are going to be imported here and used against black people, and the same tactics and strategies used against black people will continue to be exported out and used against Palestinians. So we see this again as a militarized training center, which is going to damage movement activity and organizing, and also continue the over-policing of the larger black community.
No, so that's a great point, and there's a lot to unpack there, which we will get to. But I want to start on, so there's this Cop City, and you know, we're both located here in Atlanta where we're talking, and I will say, as someone based here in Atlanta, watching the movement that has built up around Cop City has been inspiring. It's been amazing, and it has included many parts, including Palestine, which we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if you can talk some first just about the movement in general. Who is it made up of? What are the different interests, and how has it developed to this point?
Yeah, well, it's a vast movement. I would say at its core, it's been local organizers of sort of diverse of interests. racially diverse, ideologically diverse. I would say a core of left organizers and activists, everybody who believe in sort of anarchism, radicalism, environmentalists, climate change activists, civil rights organizers and activists, everyday community people. So it's been diverse since its very origins and beginnings. And I think the thing that's held us together with that diversity has been a common understanding of the role of the police in the particular ways in which they're being used against the Black community and working class and poor folks. And mixed with that, the placement of Cop City, which is going to be done by ripping down, at the start, at least 90 acres of forest. The Atlanta Police Foundation is actually renting 300 acres. There's nothing in the lease that prevents them from tearing down the other 200 acres. And so the idea that during a time period of climate disaster and challenges, that they're going to rip down one of the most important forests in the city, has brought together this diverse interests of organizations, collectives, and individuals. And one of the things that's really important about how the movement operates is that it has been autonomous and it has been what we call non-hierarchical, right? So folks have been able to do the things that they think are important in terms of having a diversity of tactics. And the thing that we continue to work on is sometimes you have to have a diversity of tactics with the understanding that those tactics take place in various places and are not associated with other tactics that might be being used someplace else at the same time, right? So with sometimes those understandings, sometimes clear, sometimes not, this movement has been able to hold itself together for 2 years without any real fracturing. Doesn't mean there's not disputes and discussions, but I think what's been important is that we haven't let's say, either the city or state or corporate media in particular break us apart by using a good activist versus bad activist narrative, by sort of accusing particularly folks who practice anarchism as being sort of outside the pale of what's acceptable in terms of organizing and activism, that we've held steady with a common purpose, theme, and idea, which is to build a movement to stop Cop City. And then lastly, I'll say is that this movement is now extended both nationally and internationally. And so since the state has stepped up its tactics in terms of having domestic terrorism charges and actually the killing of a forest defender in January, the attention that that's received, the unfortunate incident has led to literally hundreds of different organizations getting in touch with us, different movements of happening across the country in terms of people doing direct actions and civil disobedience actions, and folks coming here to Atlanta to participate in on-the-ground actions to stop Cop City.
Yeah, so the movement has drawn from many different movements, many different interests, and you've already alluded to this, but one of those movements has been the Palestine movement. 2 weeks ago at this point, there was a week of action here in Atlanta with dozens of different events. And one of those events was a panel on Black Palestinian solidarity in the context of the movement to stop Cop City. That was recorded. We'll have a link to that in the show notes to this. But I wonder if you can speak some to what is the Palestine connection when we talk about this movement to stop Cop City.
I think that, you know, the thing that we mentioned earlier around the ongoing contractual relationship, let's say that Georgia police, not just Atlanta, but Georgia police and these different relationships are across the country with the Israeli police department. And obviously these are, for the Israeli police, these are propaganda motives and ideas, which allow them to be more acceptable, particularly here in policing communities and then by extension, larger corporate and other communities to which they want to offer them support. We know it's not the only way in which the Israeli government tries to garner support in the United States in terms of different traveling programs and so forth. But this particular one we consider very insidious because it does involve the Israeli police. And again, the tactics and strategies that they use to continue human rights abuses, to continue stealing land, to continue killing Palestinians are, again, being trained and used here and trying to make that police force acceptable here as a force that should be training with police forces here is something I think that locks us in struggle. And I think the common histories of struggle of Palestinians and Black folks in the United States, the common history of camaraderie and working together is something that my generation, generations after me, still hold true, that the self-determination of Palestinians is utmost important to hold up in most of our struggles to show a sense of unity and solidarity.
Yeah, thank you. And one of the programs that I think you were alluding to, but that our readers might be familiar with, is one called the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange, or GILE, which we have reported on throughout the years. And this is one of many different types of efforts that takes law enforcement from the U.S. and takes them to Israel for training. And so, although Cop City isn't directly connected to GILE, there are signs that this will only further this type of training.
Yeah, I mean, because the training that happens now is very extensive. They have, as you mentioned, at Georgia State is the home office of where GILE is located. They've done statewide trainings. They've done trainings where they've taken Atlanta officers to Israel, and they've definitely had Israeli authorities come here and do joint training together. So we see something like this, which is, again, not just an Atlanta center, but a center that's going to be used for police forces in the state of Georgia and across the country. It naturally, for us, fits into the common themes of how militarized policing is done in Palestine and how it's already done here, and the furthering of those that sort of policing ethos, strategy, and tactics to be brought either further into how they deal with movements here in the United States. Because remember, again, this the idea of Cop City comes out of, in terms of its escalation of putting it forth, the 2020 uprisings against police violence. And so for us, this is a direct reaction to that. And we only see that them strategizing to stop our movements from taking place in the future against these things.
Yeah. And one of the things that's been really notable, too, about this movement that I want to move to is the really intense repression that it is now facing. One of the things that we often cover in terms of the Palestine movement in the U.S. is it's sort of this canary in the coal mine in some ways, where restrictions on speech that is geared towards Palestine then are now starting to get used on other movements. And it seems as though that might be the case here in terms of the movement against fighting Cop City. So I'm wondering if you can describe what has been some of the repression that the movement is facing?
Well, we should say, ever since we started this movement, that there have been different forms of repression by the state / city. And so in 2022, when we would do demonstrations at City Hall, or we would do demonstrations at different targets, the police would come and break up our rallies and demonstrations at the end. We've had demonstrations in total, I'd say, in 2022, where there were well over 20 arrests. Most of those arrests, though, were of obstruction of governmental administration, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest. Again, charges we would fight as being illegitimate, but at least charges that organizers and activists were used to having to fight. After the lease was passed and the forest defender strategy became predominant, and I think the city, as well as the state, and I say the state not just in terms of just the general sort of leftist term, the state, but the state of Georgia, when they saw that the movement wasn't dying, in fact, it was spreading, and in fact, it was getting more national attention and in some ways international attention, we have documents from open records requests of the Atlanta Police Foundation having retreats with law enforcement. In fact, these documents show that the Atlanta Police, the DeKalb County Police, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Homeland Security have created a task force in which they first started discussing, this is in late 2023, the idea of bringing domestic terrorism charges against organizers and activists. And then in later in December 2023, they actually raided the forest and arrested approximately 6 forest defenders who we should make sure that it's clear. These folks were sitting in tree huts and they were sitting in encampments and trees. At best, they were doing acts of civil disobedience. They have no information of either any prior actions that were any more demonstrative than that or any actions that they were planning. They were simply sitting in trees and they wanted to get them out. And then in January 18th, they went back into the forest, conducted another raid, and that's when they arrested another 5 or 6 activists and killed the forest defender, Tortuguita. A few days later, at a march downtown, they arrested another six or seven. And then, as we know, a few weeks ago, we had a week of action. And at that week of action, the policing agencies raided the music festival, and they arrested approximately 35 people with 22 additional charges of domestic terrorism. And so these charges, which if anyone reads their arrest warrants, the charges are not individualized. Basically, they have the same arrest warrants for every single person in terms of the language used, and that carries over into charging everybody that they have charged with domestic terrorism with no individualized proof whatsoever. And even the charge of domestic terrorism for something that at best, again, could be trespassing, destruction of governmental destruction of property, anything along those lines. But instead, they decided to charge domestic terrorism as a way of chilling dissent and scaring organizers and activists away from trying to fight against Cop City. Again, a movement born out of stopping police violence.
And again, just in case that wasn't clear, there were people who were arrested for attending a music concert that was part of this week of action and have now been charged with domestic terrorism.
Yes. Yes.
And can you just say briefly, what does a charge of domestic terrorism carry with it?
It carries approximately, at its maximum, 35 years in prison.
35 years in prison for attending a music concert. And just to say, to further the argument that that was being used to chill activism, I mean, this concert was a kickoff event for what was going to then be a week of activities. And one of the big headlines that came out of that was 30 people arrested and given domestic terrorism charges. So I think it seems like that strategy was very clear.
Yeah, no, it definitely was. I mean, we feel it was actually the second action. Like, so on a Saturday, there was a march in what we call Wilani Forest. And that march, people walked through the forest. They got to see where Tortuguito was killed. They got to see where other people were arrested, the approximate sites for where the actual training center, militarized training center, will be built. And then the next day was that Saturday where the music festival happened. And there was an action that was done 2 miles away. And the police used the fact that action took place as a way of breaking up the festival and then randomly and indiscriminately arresting people and charging them with domestic terrorism.
Including legal observers who were
including
there.
Including a legal observer who was watching, obviously had on a green hat that shows they were from the National Lawyers Guild, that shows that they were legal observing, and they still decided to arrest that person. Part of this we also feel is that the city/state is building up towards potential RICO charges, where they're trying to criminalize the whole movement to stop Cop City by suggesting that other organizations are engaging in or supporting or leading so-called criminal activity, or it's a criminal enterprise. And again, whether or not they can make these charges stick or not is not even the point for them. The point is really chilling dissent, creating a public narrative that this is a criminal movement as opposed to a movement to stop police violence and the militarization of police in our communities.
Yeah. And just to clarify, RICO charges are anti-racketeering charges that are typically used against organized crime.
Exactly.
Or to demonstrate a conspiracy of sorts to commit a crime.
Exactly.
And it's expected that those types of charges will be brought against protesters in this movement.
The protesters, leading organizations, folks who they've designated as leaders, they've particularly singled out the Atlanta Solidarity Fund potentially as a group that is leading the activity from afar. And so again, no charges of RICO have come down yet. But because of the bond hearings that we've been watching, the descriptions by the prosecutor's office in describing the overall Stop Cop City movement, and other information, again, it's been received through Freedom of Information Acts, it leads us to believe that larger indictments might be coming down, in which they try to do a further criminalization of the whole movement to stop Cop City.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering, what do you feel like the lessons are then for other movements going along the lines that you know, this type of repression is only being tested out here, but can be transported elsewhere. What do you feel like the lessons are?
I mean, I think some of the lessons are that a diversity, I'll start with the diversity of tactics, that movements will not be successful if they listen to the state as to what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. The very people who are repressing you, the very people that you call out for repressing you, the very people you call out for creating a prison industrial complex, for gentrifying black communities, that those folks cannot tell you how to go about trying to stop the repression from taking place. And so movements have to stop giving in to these themes and ideas about what is acceptable and how you protest when you listen to them and use your acceptable methods when 90% of the time they don't want to listen to it and they don't stop doing what they're going to do anyway. So I think having that is important. I think understanding that movements need to be diverse when they, particularly when they go after larger issues that are sort of societal importance, that sort of that diversity, again, ideologically speaking, along a certain line, but diverse in terms of location of where actions take place, diverse in terms of the politics of those engaging in the action, that all those things, like getting through all the, you know, we as organizers, we like to meet a lot, but getting through the sort of the pain and suffering of doing meetings and having differences of opinions on things, that those are things that have to be overcome if we are to develop sort of a sustained movement that stops some of the most repressive aspects of the United States in terms of its governing and its localities. Again, particularly here around how policing is conducted in black and brown communities, and mixing that again with the idea that these corporations, are tearing down, different aspects or parts of the forest, and changing climate, in general through their, by the things that they make and the ways in which they operate, that if we don't come up with stronger ways to stop them, then we will always be on the losing end of this fight.
As we move towards wrapping up, I have two more questions. And the first one actually is not so much necessarily just about Cop City, but it's more about the organization that you work with. Community Movement Builders. You're a founder and leader in this organization. And Community Movement Builders is a community-based organization here in Atlanta focused on fighting gentrification, fighting mass incarceration, economic empowerment in the black community in Atlanta. And when you go to the website, though, for the organization, one of the other points of unity is and imperialism and new colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you could speak to what is that connection? You're a community-based organization in Atlanta. Where does imperialism fit into this? And where does the internationalist view that Community Movement Builders has fit into the work?
I mean, yeah. I mean, for us, it's a natural connection, as in, you know, the work that we do is political work in a sense of, we don't think the policies and the ways in which those policies are enacted are just some accident that took place. And, oh, my God, look at all this inequality that's taking place out of this sort of fair and just policies that we thought would work one way and they've actually worked another. That's not what we see. We see the United States in terms of its both domestic and international history, not only domestically as a subtle colonial nation, but one that is an imperialist nation. So one that takes and tries to control people's land, people themselves, people's resources. And that same thing is true internationally as it's true domestically. That the fact that we live in a capitalist state, a state that's militarized and has the largest military, not only in the world, but has more military bases in the world. And then again, vis-a-vis bringing that home domestically, the way the police are trained to operate within black communities in particular, which acts as treats it as a domestic colony in and of itself, for us means that politics, which are strong and which have an understanding of what it is that's happening, must be omnipresent when you're doing this work. Because otherwise, you just fall for benign corporate speak. You're going to fall for benign policy and political speak when the differences between the parties of the Democrats and Republicans are not that great at all, that it's really about resource control and it's really about accepting elites of all different stripes into that body, as long as they continue to go with the idea that the role of the state is to support capitalism, it is to support the military, it is to support the control of resources, land, and property. And so we have to make sure land, property, and people, I should say. And so we have to make sure that we fight against that in the strongest terms, and that it's understood that our politics are one that's not only about here, what's happening here, but they're about sort of an international worldview of how do you stop something that has international tentacles.
Well, thank you for that. My last question is just how can someone get involved, regardless of where they are? How can they get involved in the movement to stop Cop City?
If folks go to our website, communitymovementbuilders.org, we have a page up there that's called Stop Cop City. And that gives us, gives everybody a range of ideas and thinkings and things that they can do to stop Cop City. So everything from petitions, everything from calling in, petitions and call-ins against the local politicians, the mayor, the city council, petitions and call-ins targeting the corporation that have invested into making Cop City, call-ins around the developers who are involved in trying to actually build out the space and make it happen. All of that is there. In addition to people engaging in actions locally, targeting some of these corporations and these institutions, so doing everything from civil disobedience to direct action to teach-ins to rallies and demonstrations. All of that helps support to let other folks know that this movement is ongoing, this movement is strong, this movement is not just a local movement, but this is a movement that has both national and international ramifications, and that's the way in which people can get involved.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Kamau, for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And that is it for this week. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can also stream us live every Friday morning at KKRN.org at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved in the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We'll talk again next week.